I mean, what is the American dream to you today? Because there's a real underside to this.
Yes, because there's a dispute about what that dream is or how it would play out in different circumstances. And of course, you know, everybody in the United States and probably beyond, but most especially those of us who have to live under the Trump regime, are constantly being shocked day after day after day.
You're listening to highlights of the Creative Process and One Planet podcast's interview with David Palumbo Liu, professor and author of the book and podcast, Speaking Out of Place, Getting Our Political Voices Back. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
As you know, talking about, as I did a moment ago, American institutions, Trump has effectively destroyed nearly every one of them. Fortunately, at a certain level, the courts are holding up. And fortunately, the people are standing up finally. And I think that's been one sign of great hope. But for the MAGA base, and it's diminishing, fortunately, the American dream is essentially been narrowed into a white Christian nationalist notion of things, so that everything that falls outside what they imagine that to be is not only undesirable, but should be the subject of extermination, deportation, detention, massive investigations, you know, former directors of the CIA, FBI, anybody who is perceived to disagree with Trump is put under immediate investigation because those things have to be eradicated. On the other side, what we see, and this is something that comes out in the interview I did with Ellen Schrecker, who's a long-standing American historian of McCarthyism, is that unlike McCarthyism, Ellen points out, this time around, people are standing up. And it's been incredibly heartening to me to see. There was a recent story about suburban grandmothers in Chicago standing up to ICE, deportation. So I think it's tapping into the best and the worst of us. And I think that I'm heartened by the fact that more and more of the better angels, I think, are coming out with a more capacious and expansive notion of what the American dream could be.
And I always wonder, when you're an activist, how do you measure the success when it's been such a long haul?
Here? That's such a, I ask that question nearly every episode. And when I had Nick Mirzoff on again, he quoted John Berger's notion of undefeated despair. And then Robin Kelly has the line, success without victory. And there are many different variations of it, which is that small successes that don't necessarily amount to a total victory, but just day by day, leaving possibilities open. Small victories like having somebody wave to you in a neighborhood that would not usually recognize you. All those things leave possibilities open. And I think it's important, Berger's expression is so meaningful because we have to acknowledge our despair. It would be foolish for us to tough it out, imagine that, well, it doesn't count. Of course it counts, but it's a despair that then feeds into an even more profound commitment, I think, precisely because you recognize it. And that's where the undefeated part comes in, right? You recommit, so it's not defeated. It's still alive, but it's cognizant of the enormity of the task. And again, something else we've talked about today a lot is the sense of breaking the isolation, and even if it's momentary, but it shows up in all sorts of almost banal ways. When I'm on my walk in the preserve, and I've taken now to being more systematic about saying hello to people, you know, just seeing the smile on their faces and they reciprocate. Even that sign of recognition is important, because otherwise we're hunched over our phones or in our darkness, feeling like there's nothing we can do. But again, I think in the United States, I've never seen such a mass movement. Closest thing to it was the anti-war movement. This galvanizes people, and this is where Marjorie Taylor Greene comes back. It has people from both sides of the aisle, so to speak. Now, as you say, she's a politician, so you never know what calculation she's making. But what lies behind it, regardless of what her actual motive is a recognition that the old two-party system isn't working. And actually, I don't know if you've watched, she's gotten to be quite popular, she's an historian, Heather Cox Richardson. I don't agree with her all the time, but I think she has exactly the right sensibilities. And she's constantly comparing this to the mid-19th century, when you had, again, the robber barons, and you had this notion that only the most entitled elites were capable of running a country because everybody else was dumb or stupid or whatever. And she said, somebody asked her, do do you think we should have a third party? And she said, I think no, that in the United States, the two-party system is there to stay. However, parties can change. And I think this gets back to Mamdani. I think the Democrats, and maybe even the Republicans at some later stage, are recognizing that people care about basic things. They don't care about, you know, pronouns. They care about having food on the table. They care about health care. And this cuts across whether you agree with somebody in terms of issues of identity, issues of sexuality and whatnot. I think everybody deserves, and this gets back to basic human rights, a right to an education, a right to health care, a right to retirement, and a right to have a voice in the way the state runs and have reasonable disagreements. I think that's fine. But when we're so polarized, which I've never seen anything like this in my life, for such a sustained time, to the point that our president tears down half the White House and people say, well, that's fine. It's just, I think people finally reached a point of saying, no, it's not fine. And in this, I don't want to call it a renaissance because it should not be a renaissance. It should be a revolution in the sense of bringing something new into the world. I think this is going to be a very interesting next 4 years. It's going to get worse before it gets better, which is why we need to be undefeated in our despair. Dehumanization works when you take away the human contributions that people make. You erase the fact that we are so dependent on migrant labor. There's no question about it. When you substitute the narrative, they're all criminals, they're stealing things, rather than the opposite, which is that they're giving us things, that is really devastating. And the robber barons were actually robbers. And Woody Guthrie, the famous American folk singer, has the line, some men rob you with a pistol, some with a fountain pen. And this is what happened during the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, right? When you had bankers going in and robbing the farmers by having them take out huge loans to get the kinds of tractors and combines they would need to be competitive at that time. So I think that, and of course, here I am at Stanford University with one of the great robber barons, Leland Stanford, who famously hired a number of ex-Civil War soldiers to hunt Indians. This is, and Malcolm Harris in his book on Palo Alto lays this out very forcefully. So we are in another Gilded Age. There's no doubt about it when you have the Peter Thiels and Sam Altmans deciding that democracy is an interesting but dispensable artifact, but what's needed now is brilliant people like themselves to determine what is good for the rest of the planet, not just other people, but the entire planet. That's a level of robber baronness beyond imagination. And people are finally, again, getting very disgusted with it when they see the degradation of life for most people, the cost that we're bearing for this robbery at that level.
What would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
It's very interesting. I'm going to borrow from somebody I recently interviewed. Her name is Nilo Tabrese, and she works for the Washington Post. She works in the visual forensics area. And her book, she co-authored a book about the Iran rebellion, Women, Life, Freedom. As somebody in visual forensics, she has to, and she writes about it in the book, in order to substantiate a story, she had to look through thousands of photos of tortured bodies. And I said, how do you do this? And she said, and this will be on the podcast, so I'm not divulging anything she didn't divulge to me for the public. She said, I have a really good therapist who said, you need to turn off. You just have dedicated time to do something else because you cannot, I know you're passionately committed to getting the truth out, but you need to take care of yourself. So self-care is so important. And again, self-care should not be something like 15 minutes a day of doing something, you know, minimal. The world, I mean, one thing that I say to myself all the time is the world can get along without you. That's, you know, I can make that. That's not the same as saying that I don't make a contribution, which you so graciously articulated a moment ago. But the world will be fine. I mean, in terms of nature, not human world, but the natural world is amazingly resilient. And the human world has other people to carry on. So we are all interdependent. And as long as you're doing what you can when you're engaged, that means that you not only deserve, but you need the arts, you need music, you need to be quiet and be silent. So all those things are for your good and for everybody's good that you contribute to. It's not a luxury, it's not cowardice, it's not you backing away, it's you. I mean, I'll tell you a story that I've told on the podcast before, and this goes back to the first Trump administration. And when he had the Muslim ban, there were spontaneous demonstrations at major airports, right? I remember going to the San Francisco International Airport, and there were just masses of people. And I ran into my dean there, which I was very surprised and gratified to see. I had another commitment, and people, I just noticed, again, it's nothing I said, I just noticed people were leaving. But as they left, again, just organically, new people would come in. And I think that serves as a metaphor and a symbol of what I'm trying to get at. Is everybody has other parts of their lives. Nobody's a full-time activist. And everybody needs time off. But as long as we share a spirit of common values and common interests, then there'll always be somebody else. So that's something else to remember.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.